Conversation Extra from the BBC Archive, we've recovered 24 minutes of an original 40-minute interview from April 1969, recorded in America. Tony Thomas speaks to Danny Kaye.
I don't know where and when it occurred to me. I believe it's something I had to do. You know, I've always been of the opinion that if a man is given equal opportunity, he usually becomes what he has to become rather than what he wants to become. What I wanted to be, strangely enough, was a doctor. And what I evidently had to become was an entertainer. Because in that way, I probably expressed myself considerably better than if I had been in medicine, just as people have to become painters, or have to become musicians, or have to become writers. It seems for them that it works best in order for them to be a whole person within themselves.
Does it occur to you that you might have wound up a funny doctor?
Oh, I don't think so. There are a lot of amusing things that happen in medicine, as a lot of my medical friends have told me, but medicine is a fairly serious business, as, in a strange way, so is comedy.
You must have found some fulfillment as the surgeon in The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Yeah. That was a funny scene.
That is my favorite picture of yours. I suppose because some of us feel an empathy with the character of Walter Mitty, the man who would like to be so many things.
Oh, I think there's a little bit of Walter Mitty in everybody alive, men and women. If we didn't have dreams to retreat into or fantasies that we could explore the rest of the world in, we probably wouldn't be able to make it at all. And I'm sure you've had awkward times or awkward moments or depressive ones, and a little fantasy or a dream sometimes is a little bit of sugar helps the medicine go down, as they say in the song.
But what about yourself? If you have the Walter Mitty complex, you can really get it out of your system by being many things as an entertainer.
That happens week after week on our show. And I feel that I have an enormous advantage in that respect because I can actually live out a lot of those dreams that many of us have.
Are there any unfulfilled dreams in your life?
Oh, I don't think so. Not yet. I may get to some when I get to be about 90, I hope.
But you do so many things. You can conduct a symphony orchestra. You can fly an airplane. You can cook wonderfully, as I know from our lunch today. Why do you have this drive to do all these things?
I think you have phrased that question not quite correctly. I don't have a drive to do them. I have a desire to do them. I am not driven to cook, and I am not driven to fly, neither am I driven to entertain. It is what seems to give me the greatest sense of fulfillment. I enjoy very much what I do. Specifically, I enjoy my work, my profession, my job. I think it gives me the greatest amount of pleasure anybody could get out of their vocation. And I'm very lucky in that respect because many, many people spend their entire lives not really caring for what they do. And I have been lucky and very fortunate in the sense that I am crazy about what I do. I love being in show business. I love performing. I don't think there's anything in the world I would rather do. Perhaps the only other field, as I mentioned before, the only other field that might have given me this kind of happiness would have been medicine, but I don't think it would have had as many different facets for me as this has. I have an enormous sense of curiosity, and I had been flying in airplanes for many, many years, and I suddenly decided one day I'd like to find out how it's done, or why the airplane stays in the air, or what are the aerodynamic principles, and a lot of my friends fairly frightened of airplanes. And then anybody who tells you that it's as easy to fly as it is to drive a car, I would sit back and guffaw very loudly at him because it isn't true at all. It's considerably more difficult to learn to fly than it is to drive, and it's more complicated, and it's a great sense of accomplishment. I like cooking because, in a strange way, cooking is like painting or writing. You express yourself. Oh, you may read books and may talk to people about the various things that go into making a particular dish, but I will bet that if you gave five people the same amount of food exactly, with the same amount of condiments, the same amount of ingredients, and they all followed the exact same recipe, that the five dishes would be, and not entirely, but they would have different qualities. They would have something of the person in them, just as if you were painted by five different portrait painters. Now, you are the same fella, but they would see you in five different ways. Mm-hmm. I have come home from the studio some night when we've had a particularly rough day, either discouraging or difficult physically, and I have found that the way I cook reflects my emotional state at the time. And many times I felt upset about something and I didn't cook nearly as well.
Music plays a vital part in Danny Kaye's life. He somehow, without any training, has acquired enough knowledge to be able to conduct an orchestra. And he has put it to good use to raise money for charity. He's conducted many of the major symphony orchestras of North America and appeared as a baton wielder in London and Israel. What does it take to present himself on the podium?
Well, the first requisite for that is an enormous amount of nerve. I don't play any musical instrument. I cannot read any music. I learn everything by ear. And I do it because I usually do it at a benefit concert. So I'm not really there to demonstrate my prowess as a skilled conductor. For the very same reason that I can communicate with audiences on the stage, both adults and children, I think for the same reason can I communicate with members of an orchestra. I don't think there's anybody in the world who wouldn't like to do one of two things, write a song and lead a band. Now, there's a Walter Mitty thing, you see. Everybody would like to lead a band. Everybody would like to write a song.
But the thing is that most people who would love to do these things never get around to doing it. You do. That's the difference.
Yeah, it's where you get a lot of nerve, you know. I've got no business conducting the New York Philharmonic or the Boston Symphony or the Philadelphia Orchestra, but I do. And what's strange about it is that I know all the things that we're playing, and where I learn to conduct, I'll never know. But the men in the orchestra follow, and they play. They play differently in a funny way. You know, when they do a serious concert, there is the kind of element of perfection that they try to attain. This is their job. They're professional musicians, and they try to play the concert as well as they can. Now, when I come to conduct, it does three things. First of all, it affords me a great deal of pleasure. Secondly, the audience is entertained very highly, I believe. And thirdly, and the most important, is that it adds money to the coffers of the pension fund. Now, conversely, because the fellas are not quite under the pressure of playing a serious concert, they are freer within themselves. And being freer within themselves, they play with a great deal more freedom, and the orchestra sometimes sounds quite different.
One of your great talents is this ability to command large groups of people. I think Sir Winston Churchill commented on that you had an uncanny ability to hold a group of people, and he thought you'd make a devastating political opponent.
What he said is really marvelous. It was in, I think, 1949, and he had just been defeated, you know, in the general election. and he'd come to the Palladium, the audience just went wild when he walked in. Well, after the show, I met him. I was introduced, and he shook hands with me, and he looked at me for a long second. And he said, "Young man, your control of an audience is terrifying. You would have made a formidable adversary." And right on top of that, he said, "You know that trick where you turn around and put your back to the audience?" He said, "I used that trick in Canada many years ago." And he went on to tell me about all the things he had done in relating them to politics as applied to show business, you see. And it's one of the great memories of my life anyway. Most of us are not at home or at ease with a lot of people because most of us are not at home or at ease with ourselves. And you will find that people who feel rather easy with themselves can be easy with other people. If you are basically concerned about the other person, you will find that you are more at ease with yourself because your attention is drawn to the comfort of the other person.
Do you feel happier in front of an audience than you do, say, in a small room with a couple of people?
No. No, I feel happy in a small room. I'm quite happy now. I feel just as happy with a large group. I don't have any particular problem about either one. I like to read. I spend a considerable time alone, which is very hard for people to understand because, you know, when people see me, they always see me professionally. And they see me either at a concert or on a weekly television show or in a movie or making a chariot appearance. So they think that comprises the greater portion of my life, but I do spend a great deal of time alone.
The assumption would be that you must be the most gregarious person in the world.
I can be. On the other hand, I can retreat and be by myself and be quite happy.
You do have this reputation of being something of a double personality. When you're in front of a large group of people, you light up. It's like a pinball machine. And then you can, as you say, retreat and become almost reclusive.
I think when you expend a lot of energy in any field, there must be another field you can go to in order to recoup some of that energy. When I work on the stage, people say, "How can you stand up on the stage for an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes, and give so much of yourself to the audience without being exhausted?" Well, look, there's one of me giving a lot. But by the same token, I now am getting a lot from the audience. So the thing becomes like a chain event. I may give them a great deal, but they give me back so much more in return that it more than makes up for the energy which I expend.
You don't have the need, as some comics appear to be on all the time.
No. Not at all.
Well, somewhere in your life, a fire must have been lit underneath you to give you this propulsion to take you where you are. What kind of circumstances would account for this in your early life? Great ambition, energy?
No, I think great ambition all of a sudden takes on an unhealthy connotation, the way it's said now, great ambition. Many people have great ambitions to do something, but it isn't necessarily a destructive force. Ambition can be a very healthy thing, otherwise many of us would never get anywhere. Now, using ambition in a destructive way can be very damaging for yourself and for a lot of other people. But I think it's wanting to be good at something which describes it more than ambition. Wanting to be good at something of necessity has its own escalating steps. You know, you're good at something and you achieve a place of importance, and then if you become better at it, you know, you keep rising in your own profession, whatever it might be. It's a degree of excellence that you always try to attain. You almost never do, but you try.
Well, referring to those early days, you sing a song called PS 149. Is that an allusion to early education?
Yeah, I went to a public school, and it was Public School 149, and it was in Brooklyn, New York. And I had some very happy memories of it, some terrible memories of it. Most of us become selective, you know, and most of us can't live with terrible memories, so we manage to select the ones that give us pleasure. I have the kind of memory that remembers everything, the pleasant things and the unpleasant things. That in itself creates a balance, you see.
What is there about Brooklyn that sends people out to conquer the world?
I don't know, the same thing that you get about Texas. I think it's because so many people have made fun of Brooklyn and have made fun of Texas that they become a little bit oversensitive about it. I have been in this profession for many, many years, and my first movie was a culmination of many years of playing in stock companies and traveling all over the world and in nightclubs. And then it eventually, you know, I eventually got to the movies. But I don't think anybody breaks out on the scene overnight. The audience may see them break out overnight, but I think most of it is preparation. I think one of the reasons that we're not developing as many new young people as we used to in the past is because there's no place to train anymore. With television, you know, creating the demand for so many new things all the time, people do not have the place to go and practice and develop. To put it strangely, there's no place to be lousy anymore.
You can't afford to be.
That's right. You can't afford to go out and try something and have it be a failure and then say, well, let's see, maybe we can do it another way. It's like, you know, a Broadway show going out to play in a town where they keep rewriting and changing and all that. Anytime a youngster goes on television now, he has to be a hit instantaneously. So there's no place to develop the instinctive talent that some of our young people have.
But you had years of the various theatrical circuits. I mean, the Catskill circuit, the Borscht circuit.
Many.
And that's how you learned the trade, by going through the mill.
I did almost everything you could possibly do in show business. I don't think I could pick any one specific thing that catapulted me into the position I'm in now. One of the great things that happened was when I played at the Martinique. But again, through the Martinique, I met Moss Hart, who then put me in Lady in the Dark. So it was a series of events, you know, that kind of led into one another and eventually led to this.
How did you evolve this peculiar technique of yours, the fast double talk?
It's nothing new.
You made it sound new, though.
Well, people singing fast songs. Anybody who's a Gilbert and Sullivan fan knows that they have done that for hundreds of years, or 100 years, or however old it is. Maybe nobody had done it in the popular idiom that we do it now.
And the peculiar succession of sounds that you made.
That started, strangely enough, when I was in Japan. Many years ago, I was in a show, and the only way that I could manage to communicate with a Japanese audience was to get key Japanese words and do all this gibberish in between, along with pantomime, so they would be able to follow the notion that I was doing.
One of the most famous recorded numbers of yours is Tchaikovsky, in which you rattle off 50 Russian composers' names in succession.
56 in 38 seconds.
How long did it take you to do that?
I don't know, a couple of days, I guess.
Did you have Russian blood?
Yeah.
Russian background?
Yeah.
Well, that might help a little bit.
Yes, it does. I was the only member of my family born in this country. My parents and my two brothers were all born in Russia.
You were mentioning a moment ago communicating with a Japanese audience. Now, you have communicated with children all over the world. You seem to be a veritable Pied Piper. Now, how do you do this? You can entertain kids who have no idea what you're talking about.
Very simple. It really is very simple. All you have to do is be a kid. But you see, most adults that I know are far too inhibited to behave like children. Consequently, they can't communicate with children. See, now, adults sometimes make the best children. But we wear, you know, grown-up clothes. And we stand taller than kids. And we live in a society that demands certain kinds of behavior from an adult.
We must be dignified.
Why?
I don't know why. That's one of my inhibitions, I suppose.
Well, there you are.
But you seem you do have an affinity for kids. I mean, does this occur to you?
No, it's nothing I ever stopped to examine. I was always able to deal with children ever since I was a kid. And it seemed to just go on. I don't have any special talent for it.
You feel at ease in the company of kids?
Of course I do. But you, for instance, wouldn't. Well, you might feel at ease with children alone. But if any adults walked in and you were behaving like a kid with kids, you'd get terribly inhibited, wouldn't you? Well, I don't. Well, I had started working with children on a local level, then on a community level, then on a state level, then on a national level. And I met Maurice Pate. He was really a superior human being. He was the head of the United Nations Children's Fund. An incredibly gifted man for organization and for long-range planning and seeing how the United Nations Children's Fund could best fulfill their function in helping children to achieve some kind of maturity throughout the world. Anyway, I met Maurice Pate, and he asked me if I would, on one of my trips, you know, go and see some of the installations, you know, that UNICEF had around the world. And I did. And I became terribly involved with it, both emotionally, physically. And you see that thousands upon thousands of people who devote their lives and their energies and their emotions to improving the lot of children throughout the world, it's a miraculous thing to see. People who are unsung, unheralded, who will never be in the public eye. All I do really is to bring back information about it. They actually work at it. He died about a year after I met him. Now, I have a friend called Sir Alexander King who arranged for me to meet Sir Harry Lauder when I first arrived in Glasgow. And I thought we were going out to his house, but we pulled into this station. I think it was the Central Station. And he said, come along with me. I want to take you somewhere. And we went upstairs and we walked into a room. And there was Sir Harry Lauder. And I shook hands with him. And he said, "Ugh, how do you do?" He said, "I've been hearing about you for a long time." And I said, "Well, Sir Harry, I've been hearing about you all my life." And we just hit it off just great. And we spent the evening together. There was a little dinner party given. And then I went out to spend the day with him at Straven, you know, at his house. That's where he gave me his cane.
And then when you left Glasgow, you had the crowds outside your window singing, "Will you know,
will
come
you
back
know, again?" Come back again. It absolutely dissolved me. Boy, I thought I was kind of beyond that kind of thing, but this whole crowd of people gathered around the square in front of the Central Hotel, and they said, "Give us a song." And I said, "Well, I've been singing for you all week. Why don't you sing for me?" And as though somebody had conducted them, they started to sing, "Will You Know, Come Back Again?" And I just went to pieces.